Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. When we think about how to be healthy, we think about food and exercise. For many of us, that includes regular medical checkups. But what really drives health? Experts say it's what we call the social determinants of health: education, housing, employment, and the environment, which impact our health collectively much more so than healthcare per se. Today, I want to focus on housing, why some lack it, and for others, it can be substandard, not kept up, not safe, not well lit or heated, or not close to a reliable source of healthy food. Matt Letzig, interim CEO of the Tulsa Housing Authority, and Terry Cole, the Vice President for Assisted Housing, are here. They'll explain the workings of the agency and housing policy in general in Tulsa and the United States, and some of the opportunities and challenges we face locally with regard to housing our most vulnerable citizens. The Tulsa Housing Authority began in 1967 and is coming up on its 50th anniversary. It provides housing to 19,000 Tulsans. Matt Letzig, interim CEO, and Terry Cole, Vice President for Assisted Housing of the Tulsa Housing Authority, are my guests today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Matt Letzig and Terry Cole, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start with you, Matt, and I just want to let's get an overview of Tulsa Housing Authority. When did it start, and how many Tulsans does it serve?
Yeah, the Tulsa Housing Authority has been in existence since September of 1967. So we're coming up on our 50th anniversary this upcoming September.
And how many Tulsans are you serving now?
Overall, our programs at one time, we have just over 19,000 Tulsans. So about 1 out of 20 Tulsa residents get assistance through THA.
And is it solely based on income? Is that the key determinant?
It's primarily.
Okay. And are there health considerations too? I mean, if someone is disabled or...
Yeah, elderly and disabled qualify as well as low-income individuals.
Okay. You have sort of, as I understand it, two programs, right? So there's like the Section 8 program, which is, maybe I'll turn to you, Terry. Is that a federal voucher program?
Yes.
Okay.
The program was formerly known as Section 8. They had changed it several years back. It's called the Housing Choice Voucher Program. However, most families and individuals know it as Section 8.
Do the income qualifications on that change every year or vary?
Yes, HUD sets those income limits every year. Families must be low income to qualify for both of our programs.
And what the other program being properties that you guys own, right, or the Tulsa Housing Authority owns?
Yes, for both our public housing and our voucher program, you must be low income to qualify. And we house the elderly, the disabled, and then families as well.
And are those... Both programs have the same income threshold, I guess is what I'm asking, or are they different?
Actually, to be eligible for public housing, you can be a low-income family, but to qualify for the Section 8 program, you must be very low or extremely low.
Okay. You were telling me offline, Matt, that the THA, you were essentially closed to Section 8 housing as until about 2 years ago, right, when the list sort of reopened?
As far as our wait list for applications, that's correct.
And so how long, I guess, had you been closed to applications?
3 years in 2011.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so basically if someone was low income and I guess struggling to find housing, they couldn't even apply to THA. So it was I think you guys explained to me it's sort of a supply and demand issue. There just simply wasn't enough Section 8 housing stock. Is that the way to refer to it?
HUD limits how many vouchers we can have on the street at one time based on funding. So we're normally 98% leased or better. And so based on the available vouchers, if someone moves off the program, just the timing to get onto the program was 3 years and beyond. It's just based on the number of people on the wait list.
So somebody applies for assistance for housing and the wait time is, on your website it says anywhere from 12 to 36 months. So there's a significant time. And what are folks doing in that, you know, that meantime while they're sort of adjudicated or while they wait? I mean, it sounds like anything from living with other family members to, I mean, shelters and things like that.
Yes. Typically, some of the individuals, because the voucher program, the waiting list is quite long. Currently, right now, we have over 6,000 individuals on that waiting list. They will apply for a public housing. The public housing waiting list is a shorter term. It can be anywhere from 6 months to 12. So some of those individuals, depending on the bedroom size, we can house them even quicker. We also look at preferences, individuals that apply for assistance. If they have a preference, that moves them up on the waiting list. Anyone that's elderly or disabled, a veteran, any individual that is living in a shelter or is in a domestic violence situation, those individuals will receive a preference on the waiting list and their waiting time will be shorter.
Wow. Well, that certainly makes sense. So it's almost like a triage type of situation. But one thing that makes me curious is how do you determine I mean, if someone says, oh, I've been abused or something, I mean, do you have to have a police report with that or something? Or, if they've been to domestic violence intervention services and have a write-up or something to present along with their housing application?
Right. They do have to provide verification. Usually it could be something from a caseworker if they're working with someone, whether it be the DVIS here in Tulsa or Family and Children Services. If they do have a restraining order against somebody or a protective order, they could provide that information, and then that would give them the preference on the waiting list.
How big is the organization? How big is THA?
Currently on the voucher program, we are able to administer over 4,800 vouchers.
And how has that number fluctuated over the years? I mean, when the downturn came in 2008, were you granted more availability to provide vouchers, or did it actually go down because tax receipts went down or something?
We've actually been able to maintain at least the minimum 4,800 vouchers throughout the last few years. We've received some special purpose vouchers, which are they're called our VASH vouchers, which stands for Veterans Administration Supportive Housing Vouchers. And those vouchers house homeless veterans. And we work very closely with the VA in identifying those individuals and getting them housed.
Yeah, my understanding is Mental Health Association of Oklahoma is working to, zero out the homeless veteran population, try to get them all housed in 2016, and it's been extended a little bit into 2017. So do they have caseworkers as well, mental health, with whom you work?
Yes, we're actually part of the continuum of care for Bill 2016 and what was previously known as Zero 2016. So we work with them in trying to identify those homeless individuals with the day center and the other shelters in the community to get them housed.
Okay. And Matt, how long have you been CEO of Tulsa Housing?
I'm the interim CEO, and I've been since July.
What had you been doing beforehand?
Accounting. I moved up from accountant one
all
the way to controller.
So, and you went from, sort of looking at the books and the numbers and things to sort of having a broader vision for the agency, authority?
Yeah. I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of the budget and how the HUD funding impacts THA. So some decisions we've made, we were able to reevaluate some stuff. And from a financial side, I can kind of put that spin onto what we do.
So 1967 is when Tulsa Housing Authority was founded. Is it safe to say it was sort of a Great Society program, out of the Johnson era?
We started from the Oklahoma Housing Authorities Act, which is from 1965. And similar to that, it was to provide safe and affordable housing to residents of Oklahoma. And so we were able to get on for the city of Tulsa and built several public housing properties right out of the gate.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guests today are Matt Letzig and Terry Cole. Matt is the interim CEO, and Terry Cole is the vice president for assisted housing at the Tulsa Housing Authority. And we're looking at housing as really one of the social determinants of health. Terry, how many housing units do you own and maintain, that the authority maintain?
We have 2,500 public housing units that we own and maintain currently and provide rental assistance to those families.
And are those all over town? Or how do you determine, what neighborhoods to either purchase or build homes in?
The properties were built back in the
early
70s. And so they're found, we have some out east, we have a few in the west, and then we do have several properties that are located up north.
And so those are, it's a static group of homes. In other words, they were built when there was a time where there was some funding available to build public housing. And then since that time, we haven't really added to the stock, as it were.
In 2006, we finished the Hope 6 development called Country Club Gardens. Back in 1998, there was a Hope 6 grant that HUD or DHA received from HUD for $28 million. So essentially, we took Osage Hills, which was one of our properties that was in drastic need of repair, demolished it to the ground, and we rebuilt it back as a mixed finance property. So it now has 243 public housing units and 110 regular market units. So it's kind of a mixed finance community, and that's how redevelopments typically have been done the last 10 or 15 years across the country.
And help us understand the thinking on that, because it intuitively makes sense, right? Because we saw, I used to live in Chicago, big cities like Chicago, where public housing, started out looking fine state-of-the-art apartments or housing complexes, but inevitably fell into disrepair and became sort of these oases of poverty or crime or things like that. And it took on a sort of negative connotation. So now what we're seeing is housing authorities, this mixed income type of model where they have subsidized housing along with market rate housing. Do we know the data that that's more sustainable?
From an affordable standpoint, it seems to Deconcentrate, which has had a big push for them to not have all the low-income living with low incomes. It helps from that standpoint. From our side, you have additional revenue coming in from a business standpoint. Instead of just public housing dollars, you've got market dollars, which have higher rents. Hopefully that comes in and helps us be able to afford cost.
And are you guys a fully a government agency or a sort of a quasi-government agency slash nonprofit?
Quasi-governmental is what we'd qualify.
Okay, and so the rental income you make gets reinvested. I mean, you're not like paying taxes, for example, on area.
Correct,
okay.
And the money stays within the program it's collected for.
Are there, given our state's budget problems, I mean, obviously you're very connected to federal dollars with the HUD program. Are there other sources of revenue from the state, county, or city governments in Tulsa Housing Authority?
There's a very small amount, about 90% of our funding, which annually we make over $50 million, comes into the city of Tulsa. About $45 million of that's directly from HUD. And about $4.5 million is from tenant rent. And so there's maybe 2% that we get from various other sources of income. The state right now, we're not getting any money from the city. We have a couple CDBG grants, which are HUD grants awarded to the city that then they subgrantee out to other agencies, which THA is one of those.
So has that mixture changed over time? I mean, did there used to be sort of a better balance of other government sources, or
primarily we're federal.
Primarily.
It's been that way the entire 50 years.
Okay. Is Tulsa Housing Authority able to provide social services in its housing, whether in Section 8 properties or in the ones you own? I mean, are there social workers that work for you or that you're able to work with for, you know, we talked about domestic violence, but what about things like medical needs, durable medical equipment, or social work related to, you know, school attendance for children? I can think of other things, mental health, for example.
At our public housing properties, which we have 13 total, we actually have a service coordinator on staff, on THA staff at each one of those properties.
At each one, okay,
good. And they work with different partnerships throughout Tulsa to bring services in. And then at the family sites, which make up 9 of those 13, they're with the children once they're out of school until we close, but they help with homework assistance. They'll do activities, sometimes field trips to museums and stuff in the summertime as well.
I like the sound of that. Is their background in social work or education or healthcare or all of the above? And sort of you just find whoever has the interest and the commitment to do it, to work in those positions.
Yeah, it's pretty much all the above. Social services is primarily where we get those candidates.
And does THA offer like medical facilities in any of its sites?
We do have right now Morton Healthcare at Sandy Park, which is one of our public housing properties out in West Tulsa. They have two of our units we deprogrammed, and they have a health service clinic that they've got funded through a separate grant that they offer to our residents in the community as well.
That's pretty nice. So they co-locate or bring the health care services
onto one of our properties.
Great. And that's, you say they're grant funded to do that, but do you have to contract with them in order to do it, or is it they doing it as sort of a public service and because they, in a sense, get business out of it?
As part of their application, we signed a partnership agreement that mm-hmm. we would allow them to use. We had to deprogram 2 of our units, so we took them out of housing stock and made them available for them to use as a facility.
Matt or Terry, it might be beyond the scope of what you know, but does THA offer like preventive health services? I mean, do you like bring in, say, vaccination clinics, or is that something you rely on, say, school-based clinics to do, or other types of preventive care? Or I guess another thing, we live in Oklahoma, right? So storm protection, you know, tornadoes or thunderstorms. I mean, do you have to, because you're quasi-governmental, what mandates, if any, are you under to provide, you know, storm shelters, things like that? Does that come into play?
As far as storm shelters, there's no requirement that we have out there.
How big is the authority? I mean, how many employees do you have?
230 is what we currently have.
And has that fluctuated over time? I mean, have you seen any growth, or is it a fairly stable?
It's pretty stable. It might fluctuate 15 up or down.
What are some of the challenges you're facing now in terms of, you mentioned that, 90% of your funding is federal, and it sounds like it's pretty much always been that way, but working in healthcare, I've seen with our state budget deficits, you know, lots of cuts to education and healthcare. Was there a time when Tulsa Housing Authority was receiving, you know, any funding from the state legislature that had to go away over the last 8 years, or has it just always been relatively tiny amount?
Yeah, from an operating standpoint, we really haven't got anything from the state of Oklahoma. There's been some development stuff in the past where they've assisted with some of the funding on.
Okay. Putting on your interim CEO hat, Matt, what if you could, you know, petition this new administration, for example, or, you know, what are some things you'd like to see in your tool chest that would allow you to provide, I don't know, the optimum level of service or housing for Tulsa's vulnerable? I mean,
a couple things. I like if we could be fully funded. Right now, there's for public housing in Section 8, there's what's called proration. Every year, Congress, through appropriation awards, HUD so much money for public housing in Section 8 and all their various programs. HUD has calculations for what each housing authority qualifies for under each one of those programs. The funding that's been available isn't sufficient to cover 100% of those costs. So for 2016, they just released the final funding for public housing, and it was 90.2%. And so 10% were being underfunded right now for public housing. For Section 8 admin, it's even steeper. I think we're at 84% for calendar year 2016. So they're being 16% underfunded. So if there was a way to appropriate more dollars, that obviously would help us out just from an operations standpoint.
Wow. So where do those cuts, how do they manifest? I mean, is it having to like cut employees and salaries?
And it's we've dealt with proration for roughly 10 years. Section 8 admin took the biggest cuts, and then public housing has kind of been in the mid-90s to low-90s, and now we're all the way down to 90.2 this year. That was some of the things we did. We looked at operations, we changed some processes, and then we did look at staff, and some staff were let go.
Is the is that the HUD budget just year over year not going up reflected in the same amount of cut? For example, this sequestration that we don't even talk about anymore, but where we basically, you know, we've only made slight increases in government agencies, so you just haven't seen any the sort of necessary cost of living adjustments, so to speak. That's not really what it is, but you haven't seen any necessary increases in your budget allotment?
In that calculation, there is cost, not cost of living, but there are annual inflation increases. But even with those, we're still being funded 10% or more under.
Wow. That's pretty grim. I mean, it's hard to run an agency like that. So are you, when was the last time, I mean, do you remember even the last time you were fully funded?
Early 2000s, probably for public housing.
So it's been a rough
it's
go
been
of it.
A while. Yeah.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guests today are Terry Cole, who's Vice President of Assisted Housing, and Matt Letzig, who is Interim CEO of the Tulsa Housing Authority, which is coming up on its 50th year and providing housing, you said, to, is it about 19,000?
Tulsans.
Wow. With a what we learned on to the Section 8 waiting list, about 12 to 36 months. But for public housing that's sort of owned and operated by Tulsa Housing Authority, anywhere from 6 to 12 months, right?
Correct.
What's turnover like? I mean, do you have a transient population, or when people are sort of lucky enough to survive that waiting list period, do they hold on to their housing sort of as long as they can?
We do have turnover. We see more turnover probably in the Section 8 voucher program. We're not really sure what happens to them. Some of them, you know, we have program violations. You know, we have there are certain things that they have to do when they're on the program. So we lose anywhere from 85 to 90 individuals for the program monthly. So we are constantly pulling from the waiting list and replacing those voucher holders.
Wow. So that's a lot of turnover. And what I mean, can you say like what kinds of violations? I mean, is it just, you know, unsafe practices in the home? I mean, you know, fires or things like that, or I mean, cooking fires, or
The basic violations are if they don't provide us information. We do a criminal background check on everyone every year, so you can't have any violent or drug criminal history in the last 3 years. Especially if you're on the program, we find out that's happened, the assistance is terminated. If they don't pay their rent on time and the landlord gets a judgment, they would lose their assistance. Those are the basic things. We do an inspection of the unit once a year. If they have repairs and they fail to get those repairs done, their assistance would be terminated as well.
Is Tulsa Housing Authority able to offer, I mean, it's outside of your purview, but it would seem to me that if you have residents that are struggling in poverty, two things that would be wonderful that you could accomplish, and of course you would need a lot more in the way of resources, but would be education. So I recognize you're not in the school business, but in some way facilitating or partnering with an educational institution to provide an easy way, whether it's through online learning or bringing in someone or making it easy with transportation for folks to get to, you know, school to either complete high school or a bachelor's degree or perhaps even, you know, a graduate degree. And secondly, you know, education would be employment. So how many of your residents are employed versus, you know, unemployed? for example? Do you know? You may not know that data.
In our public housing program, we have about 23% that are employed, and in our voucher program, about 25% are employed. We also have in our voucher program, 60% of those individuals, their primary source of income is Social Security or Social Security disability. So that's a very big population for us. We do have within both our voucher and our public housing programs a program called the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, where those individuals, they set goals for themselves within 5 years to become self-sufficient off public assistance and off of housing. They set their goals may be full-time employment, maybe to get a GED, financial literacy, purchase a home, and those are things that we have family self-sufficiency coordinators that case manage those individuals. We have 250 slots for our voucher program, and we have 40 slots for our public housing program. So we partner with different agencies within the community to give them the financial literacy, if they need a GED, and we work, the library is one of our partners as well, to help them get self-sufficient and independent.
So it sounds like a model idea and program because it encompasses so much, but at the same time, it's roughly 250 or, 300 individuals across the two types of housing, but it's not a huge number. I mean, there may not be that many that want to do it, but I imagine there's more that want to do it than slots that you have available.
We have a small waiting list. I think the big fear is, they have to they set that contract to get off of assistance within 5 years. But there is an incentive as part of being on that program. As their earned income increases, there's a portion of that goes into an escrow account. So at the end of the 5 years,
they have some savings.
Yes.
And to make either a down payment.
A down payment on a house, yes. And we work very closely with them, especially, getting their credit score up or financial literacy. Home ownership is not necessarily for everyone, but a lot of those individuals that graduate from the program, they do purchase a home.
Hmm. How long has that been in existence, that program?
Since the early 90s.
Okay. Well, I mean, it just seems like that's something we should all know about. I mean, I'm glad to know that exists.
It's a great program.
That's neat. Tell us the name again, Financial?
Family Self-Sufficiency Program.
Family Self-Sufficiency Program. I mean, what's not to like about that, right?
Yes.
So you're saying the reluctance of some people to sign up for it is the fear of not being self-sufficient in 5 years. So
right.
So not everyone wants to sign up, but those that do, any sense of how successful they are in terms of getting out of public housing?
Well,
or housing assistance?
The individuals, we don't do a lot of follow-up. Once they graduate and they move out and they are self-sufficient, a lot of times we don't hear from them.
Right.
There are some that will stay in contact with their caseworkers just because they have that relationship with them. But again, it's a great program, and it's, the only fear is that, our rental assistance, it's something that a lot of them, they do, hold very closely, and it is a security for them. They know that, they're going to have a place to live and shelter. And if we're out of the picture and, for them to do it on their own, for some of them, it's a little overwhelming.
So one question I wanted to ask both of you, because this is something I think born of probably, honestly, prejudice or stereotype, but I think it's worth asking to either learn how it became that way or to dispel it, which is that specifically in Section 8 housing, which are, as I understand, owned by, individuals or corporations. In other words, those are not properties you own, but those are residences, I guess you could call them, that accept those vouchers. And the stereotype would be that those are like often absentee landlords, although I'm sure that's not always the case, but who are not good landlords, who don't maintain the properties or who, are difficult to deal with for the tenants, let's say. So where does that imagery come from? And, I guess how true is it? And then what can you do when your clients as Section 8 voucher holders, what leverage do you have to try to, rectify the situation?
Well, we do have over 1,100 participating landlords within the city. We do an inspection of the unit every year. I think you would find most units that or individual homes that you may think are a Section 8 home are not, because we do an inspection of the unit every year to make sure that it meets our general housing quality standards. We do have landlords that have to do the repairs, and the ones that don't, we terminate the contract.
So they're going to lose a source of income, essentially, or
right.
Renters.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. And so do you think this stereotype is true? I mean, is that – but you're saying you inspect the properties and make sure they're at a safe fundamental level, but I guess over the years you've had to – essentially expel some of the landlords from the program?
We haven't actually expelled any of the landlords, but there are units that we will go out to inspect, and especially if we, for the first time we go out to inspect a unit, if there's more than 10 repairs, we're just going to walk from it because the unit's supposed to be ready for us to inspect and supposed to be ready to move in when we go out there. So we do have units that don't meet our standards, and we won't put on the program.
What types of recourse do the tenants themselves have? I mean, let's say they've, you know, the facility, the apartment or home has passed an inspection. Somebody moves in, and then, you know, they can't get hot water or the heating's not working, and they've called the landlord repeatedly and there's no relief. And then do they escalate the call to you?
Yes. They would contact their leasing agent at the housing authority. And then what we do is we do what's called a complaint inspection, and we send an inspector out there to verify that the repair. And then the landlord has 30 days to do that repair if it's not health or safety. If the landlord fails to do the repair within 30 days, we will abate the rent. And again, and then if they don't get it done in another 30 days, we will terminate the contract and the tenant would have to move.
So do you have a sense of, from your clients, what, I mean, the level of satisfaction that they have with Tulsa Housing Authority? I mean, over the years, I mean, I'm wondering if you survey your residents, as it were, about, you know, things that could be improved upon or that type of thing. Or is it just, given that you've had, you know, difficulty, you don't make your full budget, you've had to let employees go essentially through attrition. I mean, that's probably got to be low on the list of concerns in terms of you've got an organization to maintain, you have properties to maintain. You know, what kind of, I guess, customer service can you provide? I mean, that's often thought of.
And customer service, it is important to us, but it has been difficult when we've had reduction in staff over the last year. And specifically within the voucher program, each of our leasing agents, they are managing over 500 families.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it could be a challenge.
Well, I mean, and you see that a lot, I think, in the public sector, too, with, you know, certainly in the mental health community where there aren't enough beds or not necessarily enough workers. You see that certainly with education, with what's going on, you know, in the teacher. We're having a brain drain out of, you know, Oklahoma's public schools because of the low pay rate. And I mean, it's so this is something that, unfortunately, I think with our, you know, sort of our state fiscal crisis, but let alone, you know, whether it's federal deficits or federal policy, we're not seeing them. Well, listen, I want to thank both of you so much for coming in and sharing with us and our listeners about the Tulsa Housing Authority. It's been very educational for me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. Matt Letzig is interim CEO of the Tulsa Housing Authority. Terry Cole is vice president for assisted housing. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.